You have any other reason for keeping silence, Mr. Tobin?
I have. The efficiency of our security services can only be impaired if their organization and technique are discussed in public.
What we can say without doubt is Russia has the intent and the capability to target the West's critical national infrastructure.
He is now prosecuted for being part of Russian procurement for their military industrial complex.
Picked it up. May have made a statement to his superiors that wherever Rames went, there was a problem. To me, that's enough for somebody to say, my God, let's have somebody look at this from an investigative point of view.
Mr. Speaker, on Monday I set out that Mr. Skripal and his daughter were poisoned with a Novichok, a military-grade nerve agent developed by Russia.
Spies of one kind or another have always been with us, although the end of the Cold War brought a lull, or at least a kind of temporary truce. But then Russia's major invasion of Ukraine in 2022 saw the expulsion of diplomats and suspected intelligence officers from European states. Now in 2024, spies and spying are back big time, according to the CIA. And that affects us all. I'm Gavin Esler. This is Not a Drill. From biblical times and ancient Babylon to James Bond and his real-life MI6 contemporaries, there's nothing new in spies, espionage and subversion. But as the current CIA director William Burns puts it in a recent Foreign Affairs magazine article, this is one of those rare moments in history as consequential as the dawn of the Cold War. Why? Because Vladimir Putin, the former KGB colonel now in the Kremlin, has reinvigorated Russian intelligence agencies, the FSB, SVR and GRU. British security experts speak of increasing subversion of Western interests, including sabotage, subversion and destabilization that needs to be countered by a new generation of Western spies. James Bond has a Walther PPK handgun. Modern agents may be able to shoot, but they also need to be competent in computer hacking and in understanding artificial intelligence. We touched on the threat of disinformation from the propaganda expert Peter Pomerantsev in our previous episode, but that's just one strand of Russian intelligence operations back with a vengeance, as the experts see it.
This year's assessment notes that during the coming year, the United States and its allies will face an international security environment dominated by challenges that intersect with each other and existing trends to intensify their national security implications. Great powers, rising regional powers, and an evolving array of non-state actors are vying for influence and impact in the international system, including over the standards and rules that will shape the global order for decades to come. The next few years are critical as strategic competition with China and Russia intensifies, in particular, of how the world will evolve and whether the rise of authoritarianism can be checked and reversed.
In February every year, the CIA and other U.S. national security organizations publish the annual threat assessment of the U.S. intelligence community. This year, it sounded the alarm. The United States faces an increasingly fragile global order, it began, strained by accelerating strategic competition among major powers, more intense and unpredictable transnational challenges, and multiple regional conflicts with far-reaching implications. An ambitious but anxious China, a confrontational Russia, some regional powers such as Iran and more capable non-state actors are challenging long-standing rules of the international system, as well as US primacy within it. In a moment, we'll hear from former CIA officer Alex Finley. But first, for an insight into what the Kremlin is up to in Ukraine, in Western countries and beyond, I'm joined by Russian intelligence expert and investigative journalist Andrei Soldatov. Andrei, can we begin with what happened when Ukraine was invaded. I mean, wasn't that a massive intelligence failure on the part of the FSB, the successors to the KGB? If you can't predict that getting into a war is going to be much more difficult than you thought it was going to be, that surely suggests a degree of incompetence, perhaps, or carelessness on their part.
Absolutely. Of course, the beginning of the war was a clear sign that things were not completely right on the side of the Russian intelligence. And specifically, it looked like the way the Russian agencies briefed Vladimir Putin about the political situation in the country, in Ukraine, was not entirely, correct. When you think about Ukraine, what the FSB actually reported to the Kremlin was that the Ukrainian state was a failed state. The interesting thing, what we know now, is that the FSB traditionally miscalculated the reaction of society. So that was the case when we had the protests in Moscow in 2011-2012. And that was clearly the case in Ukraine. It was the society, the Ukrainian society, which decided to fight back. And then the state followed. And of course, we had this great leader, Zelensky. But can we say that the information about corruptness of the Ukrainian state was completely incorrect? Probably not. The problem was that it was only part of the picture. And this was the part of the picture Putin wanted to hear and wanted to read.
Right, very interesting. Now, let's bring it up to date. Have they rebuilt? I mean, what do you make of this?
Yes, I think that now the situation dramatically changed. First of all, Putin learned some lessons from his Soviet predecessors, specifically from Stalin, that it's actually not very productive to start any repression against your own intelligence people, exactly what Stalin did, because that would discourage your intelligence agencies, because nobody wants to be sent to prison for mistakes. And there were some repressions at the very beginning of the conflict, as we know. But nevertheless, Putin quickly changed this policy. He stopped all repressions against his intelligence agencies and against his military. And his main goal was to actually encourage them and to send them a message that they have his backing and there is a way to redefine this conflict. And Putin, as we all know, he's a very skillful political operator. What he did, he completely changed the narrative about the war. At the very beginning of the war, it was about as a big Russia being humiliated by a small Ukraine. Now it is about just one country, Russia, having this big war against the entire West. So for Russian spies, what they have now is the third round of the centuries-old battle with the West. The first round was right after the revolution, and it was mostly about the 1930s and 40s, and was largely won by the Soviet intelligence agencies with all these spies like Kim Philby and all of them working for the Russians. The second round was a Cold War, and that was lost. So now it's time for revenge. And that is something which inspires a lot of people inside of the agencies. And to some extent, they found a new sense of purpose.
Can we look at what that new sense of purpose means then in terms of the borderland countries first, Ukraine itself, but also the Baltics, maybe Finland, Georgia, Moldova. And as we've seen in Lithuania, there was a very brutal attack on one of the opposition leaders who is in exile.
What we need to understand here is that the mindset of people and the Russian security services is always about a combination of two things. So on the one hand, you have this big battle with the West. On the other hand, there is this concept of extreme fragility of the Russian state. Because, of course, we all remember that in the 20th century, Russia suffered. And there was a revolution in 1917, which completely destroyed the Russian Empire. And there was the collapse of the Soviet Union. The Russian Empire and the Soviet Union had maybe the mightiest secret police to protect the political regime of the day. And nevertheless, they failed. What happened is a big problem. The other conclusion they draw from these historic events is that in both cases, the Russian emigration might be actually played a huge role. So the West, the treacherous West, helped Lenin to come back to St. Petersburg and to destroy the Russian Empire. Basically, that is the idea they actually believe in. And with the collapse of the Soviet Union, again, the West was helping during the Cold War, Russian emigration and all of that. This is why they think that people, Russians abroad, are political immigrants. They present very substantial threat. And this is why we had this attack on Leonid Volkov, a senior lieutenant of Navalny, who was hit by a hammer in Vilnius. Because for them, when you have two things, when you already have a war and you have a potential political crisis like the election, the stakes are getting really high. And for many people inside of the agencies, it's absolutely justifiable to do whatever they need to do to protect this political stability. If it means to go and kill and attack people abroad, it's fine. If it means to go to jail and kill Navalny, it's absolutely fine, because they are obsessed with this history.
That is very, very clear and actually quite scary, because one of the implications of that is when they killed Litvinenko, the attempted murders of the Skripals in Britain, and all these other events that you've been talking about and many others in Germany and elsewhere, they actually want us to know, and they want Russians abroad to know, that this is the sort of thing they can do. In other words, it's not really hidden.
Yes, absolutely. And the interesting thing that they always say two things simultaneously. On the one hand, they say all these people abroad are absolutely insignificant, and yet they believe that at some point the West might come up with some hideous strategy of using these very people, who might be absolutely insignificant, but nevertheless, they might play a crucial role at destroying the political stability in the country. Because look at Lenin. He was not extremely significant before the revolution, and just in a few months, that led to complete collapse of the Russian Empire. And that, again, reflects the sense of fragility, of extreme fragility of the country.
Andrei, you were quoted as saying that Russian intelligence services are certainly back with a vengeance. And is that absolutely obvious to you, that they pose an even greater threat than they did a few years ago?
Yes, I think so. I think this the crisis of 2022 was quite horrible for Russian agencies because first of all, because of mass expulsions of Russian diplomats. That was a big blow. But at the same time, this crisis prompted them to regroup. They are finding inspiration in Stalin's times. For instance, now we see that they are increasingly use foreign nationals in their operations. We didn't see that before. We see Bulgarians being arrested in this country. Five people in 2023. The sixth person was arrested recently. We see an Austrian national being involved in running these Bulgarians. We see that in some operations in Italy, Russian intelligence agencies used Serbs in an operation to exfiltrate an agent who was arrested. We also see that they are getting much more adventurous, much more aggressive. And the final change is that we see something we also saw back under Stalin, that it became really difficult to distinguish the methods of one agency from another. Now they are actually exchanging experiences. They share their methods. Sometimes they share their personal. Last time we heard of this kind of tactics was probably late 1940s. And it is extremely successful, I would say, and extremely worrying.
Right, very interesting. At the end of World War II, Austria, and particularly Vienna, was a hotbed for spying during the Cold War. And there are some reports now that Austria, again, is an aircraft carrier of spying.
Unfortunately, it's true. And we see that it's not only about espionage, but it's also about special operations. This is the reason why Christa Grozev, a chief investigator with Bellingcat, was forced to leave Austria, where he had lived for many years, because there is a danger, specifically in Vienna. And the reasons for that, of course, the Russian presence in Vienna is very significant. The other problem is that after so many Russian diplomats were expelled from Europe, they found a new place to be in Belgrade, in Serbia, because it is the only European country where you can actually get a posting if you get expelled from the European Union. And of course, the distance between Belgrade and Vienna is not extremely long. And that means that you might get operatives coming from Serbia to conduct operations in Austria. But I think the biggest problem, of course, is that it looks like Austrian counterintelligence agencies are not extremely enthusiastic about fighting Russian espionage, because they think that as long as it is not a problem for the Austrian state, if Russian espionage is directed against other countries, and we all know that Vienna is a hub for international organizations like OSCE and the rest of them. So it is not a big problem for the Austrian state. And probably this kind of attitude should be changed.
Just a final thought. Do you think that the Western intelligence agencies have got better at dealing with the potential for the Russian threat?
Of course, it's difficult for me to judge because I'm an outsider, right? But what worries me is that some problems are quite visible. For instance, last September, there was a huge scandal in Denmark. So there was a military intelligence officer who was first assigned to the Russian embassy in the Netherlands. He was not expelled, but he was asked to get back to Russia. And nevertheless, when he was given this position in Copenhagen, he was accepted by the Danes, which was absolutely astonishing. For me, it means that there are problems in, say, sharing information about Russian operatives. Maybe things now get fixed. I don't know. I hope so. But we see that sometimes the problem is that the European agencies, they still operate as it is a time of peace. And the crucial difference is that the Russian agencies they operate in a time of war. Just in 4 weeks, we got 3 operations. We got Navalny's killed, Leonid Volkov attacked in Vilnius, and we got a Russian defector, a Russian pilot, Kuzminov, killed in Spain. So it is a clear escalation. And the base the audacity of these operations is absolutely astonishing. Even for me, it was a big problem. I thought that it might be risky for Russian political emigrants to live, say, in Central Europe and in countries like Central Asia. But now it looks like there might be problems also in Western Europe, and we need to think about it now.
Thank you very much for talking to us, Andrei. That was absolutely eye-opening.
Thank you.
What's interesting, of course, is that seen from CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, or MI6 HQ on the banks of the Thames, the Russian threat is a crisis that's just too good to waste. That's why CIA Director Burns has been so outspoken, not just about the threats from Russia, China, and elsewhere, but also about the opportunities for the CIA to modernize and adapt in the era of artificial intelligence, facial recognition cameras, and social media. For her insights, I'm joined by a former officer in the CIA's Directorate of Operations, now author of the Victor Caro series of spy novels, Alex Finlay. Alex, can we begin with CIA Director William Burns saying in an article recently that this could be, in effect, a new era for spies, because he says it's as consequential as the dawn of the Cold War or the post 9/11 period. I'm not sure that's entirely good news, but do you kind of agree with the sentiment?
I do agree that we're definitely at, I would say, a pivotal moment of history where I think the world order is about to shift. Either we're going to secure democracy, or we're going to start losing it and move into an authoritarian period. So I agree with Director Burns that we really are at this moment that we need to start taking this into our own hands. And hopefully they're doing their job over there to make that happen and work on our side.
I suppose that some of it's obvious, but what has changed? I mean, obviously the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, but they've been nibbling at Ukraine for years and they've been causing trouble. It's not as if they've not been doing anything in the Putin era.
Well, I think what we're seeing much more now, we've become much more in tune with, is that this is much more than a kinetic war that Putin is waging. So Ukraine is the kinetic part where we actually see the militaries on the ground. But what Putin is actually doing is waging a war against democracy writ large. So the idea is Ukraine itself cannot be democratic, because then, of course, Russians might start asking for that themselves. But in fact, democracy anywhere is a threat to any autocrat, particularly Putin. But he can't fight Europe and the United States when they're united. And so part of what he needs to be doing is to break those up and to destabilize those democratic systems and those alliances. And I think what we've become much more aware of in the past number of years are these influence operations that are working to destabilize that unity. We, the public, started becoming more aware of it, I think, in 2016 with the Brexit vote and the U.S. Presidential elections with Donald Trump. And I think we've definitely seen an uptick in those types of operations.
Let's go on to that now, actually, because I was going to go on a bit more about Russia first. But this is very interesting, because aren't we doing this to ourselves in the sense that you don't have to believe Russian propaganda. You don't have to believe that Putin is a good guy or has got any real stake in Ukraine. But we do seem to believe in Britain and America in particular, some really strange things, and end up with some very odd occurrences which can only help Putin and Russia.
Well, I agree. A lot of this is in our own hands. We need to be much more media literate. We need to do a much better job of fighting these conspiracies and fighting for an understanding of what truth is. These are the fundamentals of democracy, right? And so we have to agree on what is truth. We have to agree on rule of law. And so that's why these influence operations are so detrimental to a democratic system. But we have to choose, as we said, we have to choose to defend that system. Unfortunately, I would argue, I know much less about British politics, but certainly within the United States, we now have an entire political party that is willing to take advantage of this system for their own benefit. So they are actively helping spread a number of the conspiracies. Some of them, I think, are probably actually working with Russians. If not, then the Russians know the moments to exploit and to help amplify some of the things that our own politicians are doing. So part of the problem is a lack of leadership. So when you have these political leaders who are out there and want to benefit from it for themselves, then it's much harder to fight a public and a citizens. But we do have to remain engaged. So we can. We just have to remain engaged, remain in a democracy. Democracy is engagement of the citizen, but it seems to be getting harder and harder.
I think we can agree on that. I wondered whether an old expression from the 50s, of even before the 1950s, fellow travellers might actually work here. In other words, there are people within our country and within your country and elsewhere who seem to just kind of go along with the Putin-Russian narrative in ways that are detrimental, many of us think, to our own countries. Maybe we should call them out more.
Well, that I agree. And that's actually one of the harder things here to fight against, is we probably do have among our politicians and among the public some people who just genuinely are aligned with Putin and a lot of the things that he stands for, whether it is Christian nationalism, a lack of diversity among the population, this notion of a strong, virile, masculine leader where the rules don't apply to him, the rules only apply to certain other people. We have people. Certainly Donald Trump is one of those people, but we also have a number of people within the public in the United States and elsewhere in the Republican Party who are sort of aligned with those values. So then that's a problem, because now you come down to a much more fundamental issue is, well, what are our values and what is it that we want our country to be and what we want to stand for? I would argue that those values are anathema to democratic values. They cannot both exist at the same time. And so therein lies the problem.
Where does this leave the role of the CIA, Britain's MI6, or the Secret Intelligence Service, and other intelligence agencies? Because again, a director of Central Intelligence, Burns, a very interesting article. He says that, you know, we've still got sabotage, subversion, and destabilization through undeclared Russian forces, as well as the obvious threat that Russia poses to NATO through the invasion of Ukraine. So it's become more complicated, but in one sense, we can see it more clearly.
Well, I think this is one of the things that we have seen over the past number of years. Generally, when we think about CIA and MI6 and we think about espionage, what we're really thinking about is stealing secrets, right? This is sort of what we've grown up with. And more traditionally, that's what espionage is. We're now starting to understand much better the idea of active measures. This is using the intelligence services to recruit, influence, manipulate those people who are influential in our own societies, activists, politicians, journalists. People think, oh, it's just social media, it's just trolls, it's just bots who are amplifying these messages. But it's not. This is human intelligence. These are security services recruiting people, paying them, and getting them to do these things in order to change our debate. But one of the things that we need to start getting used to is this isn't always a question of, is this a criminal act? If we look back at the Mueller report in the United States, he was the special counsel who was put in place to investigate the relationships between the Trump campaign and Russian intelligence or Russian officials. The narrative that came out of that report is, well, there was no collusion. Well, there was no criminal collusion that was going to reach the standard of evidence within a court. But from a counterintelligence point of view and from a national security point of view, if you read that report, it's stunning. There are a number of things that were very, very scary that people in these high-level positions with access to what they have access to and the influence that they have were meeting with the people that they were meeting with. And Mueller points that out in the report. And in fact, the Senate Intelligence report about the same issues, bipartisan, said the same thing, that there were serious national security concerns about those relationships. We can't necessarily point and say, well, what you're doing is illegal, but we do need to start changing how we discuss it to be able to say, this might not be criminal, but it's definitely a threat to our national security.
It's odd that so many American people don't seem to get that, though.
Well, again, the cognitive dissonance that exists in the United States now sort of just blows my mind every single time. But again, if you have an entire political party that is buying into it, again, for whatever reason, they are doing this. And most Americans, at least, I think this is probably true across Europe and across the UK and elsewhere, they live their lives. They go about the day to day. They're not watching every development as somebody like you or I might be, where we really see all of these problems. And so it's sometimes hard to break through the narratives that get blasted across, social media, but also across, TV networks and newspaper headlines and magazines when you're standing in line at the grocery store. Yeah, you have a lot of reasons that people buy into it, also because they're unhappy with their own lives. And this is the information they get. And it's grievance, right? So a lot of what these conspiracies that are pushed by Russia and picked up by the Republican Party is about grievance. And people are angry with their lives. And this gives them a really nice out to be able to blame it on somebody else.
I'm really conscious that, we spent 15 minutes, say, talking about essentially humans. And I kind of thought if I was thinking about the future of spying and tradecraft and all that, it'd all be about high tech stuff. And I know there's a new chief technology officer at the CIA, which was announced by Director Burns and so on. But it is interesting that everything we've talked about is about humans and how we process information.
Absolutely. And I was one of the big naysayers for years when everybody said, oh, technology is going to run human intelligence out the door. No, even more so now, and I believe Director Burns alludes to this in his article in Foreign Affairs, we need human intelligence even more now than we used to. Part of the problem is there's so much information that's available, right? Especially through technology. And it's available open source through Google Maps and social media and all this. And there's just so much information. But there's also a lot of disinformation that runs through those technological outlets, right? And so we have fake websites that look like the BBC or a video that gets put up that it says it's BBC, but it's not. It's actually some dude sitting in a basement in Russia. But I would argue that for the spies to get really that hardest to get information that we need to know, plans and intentions of leaders, that type of thing, you're not getting that through technical means. You may get it through a technically enabled operation, but you're definitely going to need human spies as part of those operations.
That phrase, technically enabled operation, that is interesting too, because I can foresee the old stuff. If you were writing spy novels from the 1950s and 60s, it would be, you know, secret meetings in dark corners, you know, where there's no streetlights or something. But now we assume, actually, that with face recognition, voice recognition, just about anything that anyone does, whether working directly for the CIA or not, it's very, very difficult to actually talk face-to-face to people, isn't it? Without giving them away if you've got a source in Russia or somewhere else.
It is. It's extremely difficult, especially you look at a place like China where, I mean, there's surveillance absolutely everywhere. Across Europe, you have CCTV as well. There's private surveillance as well. People can run their drones right up to your windows and these types of things. We've seen private companies getting software onto people's phones to look and spy on everything they're doing and their contacts and who they're talking to. So absolutely, it's getting harder, but there are ways of getting around that. I've been out a long enough time. I don't know what they are. So but if I knew, I certainly wouldn't discuss them. But there are certainly ways, right, to get off the grid and try to still have some of those meetings. And that's, again, why I would argue that human intelligence is still paramount.
There was one other thing about Director Burns' article I wanted to raise with you. He talks about strategic declassification, the intentional public disclosure of certain secrets to undercut rivals and rally allies, has become even more powerful tool for policymakers. I mean, I love the phrase strategic declassification, but to me as a journalist, it means news leaks, and you put them in newspapers and television, and that changes maybe the public narrative in some way. That's a very interesting thing for the CIA to talk about publicly.
It is. And I think it's great. We first started to see that, I think, in the end of 2021, as we were seeing this build up on the frontier of Ukraine, where the Biden administration started releasing some of this information, saying, we understand that the Russians are going to do a false flag operation in this place. They're going to try to blame it on neo-Nazis in Ukraine or whatever nonsense they were going to do, trying to add and build to this narrative that Russia had a right to be going in and doing this invasion. So first of all, to your point on, is it a news leak? The thing is, they're telling you straight out, this is intelligence that we have. So it's not a news leak, because it's not some quiet source that's coming. They came flat out with it and said, this is what we have. They're not telling you the source. They do a very good job of hiding the source and hiding the methods to make sure that it's a responsible release of that information. One of the things that we saw in 2016 was what we learned later. The Obama administration actually knew that Russia was doing a lot of what they were doing in terms of meeting with Trump, trying to influence the election, stealing the emails from the Democratic National Committee. They knew a lot of this. Obama wanted to release some of that information, but he was worried politically what it would look like. He went to Senator McConnell and said, would you sign a bipartisan letter with me that we come out together and we do this? And as I understand it, McConnell refused. And so Obama didn't do that. And I still wonder, well, what if he had? And so I think the Biden administration learned from that and said, all right, we're not going to fall for this again. When we have this information, let's release it if we can do so in a responsible way to start changing the narrative before the Russians can even get it to start taking root.
I was in Estonia after the Russians essentially attacked the banking system because they were irritated with Estonia. And there's been quite a lot of that going on. There's all kinds of other shadowy groups in Russia who attack institutions in the West. I mean, obviously, the West is capable of that and all kinds of other things. Is that a question of holding back and just not wanting to escalate things?
Well, I think the question is, how is that handled? The most important thing I would argue, coming from, as we've been discussing, that because this is very much a democracy versus autocracy moment that we are in, we do want to stay on our side. We still want to follow the rule of law. That said, the CIA does do what's called covert action. It has to have a presidential finding, which means the White House has approved of exactly what the CIA is planning to do. There are a lot of lawyers who have to sign off on everything. It goes through oversight committees in Congress, and they're briefed on it every week. So it is done differently than how Putin would do it, for example, right? I mean, Putin just says, oh, let's just go do all these things, and people jump and do it. And if he doesn't like you, he could kill you for it or not, or he could send an assassination team or not. But is the CIA running covert action against Russia? I have absolutely no idea. The other issue is enabling others, right? So can you give information to others to help them do what they're doing? I don't know what the relationship is between CIA and Ukraine. But also, to go back to your point of how the Russians are attacking banking systems and civilian infrastructure. But this again goes back to my point that the kinetic part of the war is in Ukraine, but this is hybrid war against the rest of us, right? They have been attacking, again, like, you know, electrical grids. We still don't know about the Nord Stream bombing. Then you have everything that's been going on in Africa, where you have influence operations and other things going on there, trying to get control of mines and everything to feed the war, to give money to Russia to feed the war. So this is much bigger, I think, than most people understand.
Alex Finlay there. And you may like to know that in one of her novels in the Victor Caro series, Alex's hero Victor is embroiled in a national security nightmare. It happens when Russian intelligence services help install a new and somewhat crazed American president in the White House. Of course, Alex writes fiction. At least, that's what she says it is. I'm Gavin Essler. Goodbye.
This Is Not a Drill. It was written and presented by Gavin Essler and produced by Robin Lieber. Our music was by Paul Hartnell and art by Jim Parham. Group editor is Andrew Harrison, executive producer Martin Boytosh, and This Is Not a Drill is a Podmasters production.